Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Hi, this is Stephen O'Doherty. When our policymakers think about economics, do they see GDP figures and monetary policy, or do they see families, communities, and the desire to promote human flourishing? For Professor Ian Harper, one of Australia's most respected economists, it's definitely the latter. Ian is a member of the Reserve Bank Board. He's one of nine men and women tasked with responsibility for setting official interest rates. He was Australia's Fair Pay Commissioner. He chaired the government's Competition Policy Review. Ian Harper is a man of deep Christian faith who brings those values to everything he does. In a wide-ranging conversation, we talked policy stagnation, the global economy, interest rates, and more. And keep listening for his spirited defence of the role of faith in the public square. We began by talking about the roots of economics as a discipline.
It certainly was concerned about people's well-being and flourishing, as you put it. The father of modern economics, a man called Adam Smith, who was a Scottish moral philosopher. Scholars sort of debate whether he was a confessing Christian as such, but most of them agree that he was certainly a deist, so he was a believer in God. He wrote a very famous book that occurred before The Wealth of Nations, which most economists know about. That book, the earlier one, was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he spoke quite explicitly about the good and the evil, if you like, of material production. So it was clear that his thought in the world of in the Wealth of Nations was to be considered against that moral philosophical background, if not an explicitly Christian background.
Yes, it's a wonderful time of history because you've got many others in public life thinking about a way of structuring society, but it assumes a God. So it assumes that there is a greater being to which we're going to account one day. My sense of it is that we've pretty much lost that from public discourse today.
That's true, Stephen, and many of the disciplines, my own included, really, I think, since the late 19th century have walked away from any type of, well, frankly, philosophical, let alone moral, philosophical or religious foundation. The idea that you can separate the science, so to speak, away from those concerns so that you get away from that type of, in some people's view, almost superstitious belief, sticking narrowly with the evidence. No one's in favour of pursuing superstition for obvious reasons, but the notion that you should therefore treat your science in complete isolation of wider philosophical, moral or humanistic concerns, I think has been a mistake. And I think you're right that in more recent times people have begun to realise that science, pure and simple, has its limits as well.
And if we move to the discipline, for lack of a better word, of politics, perhaps discipline's the wrong word, in politics, pragmatism now rules the day. So policy is, I don't want to be too critical, but we know from our observation that the policy settings that are now put to the people are largely to do with very pragmatic outcomes like either gaining or staying in power. Are we seeing a failure of the political process?
There's often discussion, as you would know, Stephen, about whether we get the politicians we deserve. That is to say, what the politicians do is simply reflect back to us in a democratic state the types of demands that we place on them. And therefore what you're actually reacting against, the political process, we're reacting against the image that we see of ourselves.
Yes.
In the mirror, and we don't like that. I think there is something in that, to be frank. People say, well, where are our statespeople? You know, where's the statesman or stateswoman who can ride above this narrow pragmatism and give us some direction and vision? Well, good question. But those people, they need followers, prepared, in short, to trade off short-term costs against longer-term benefits. So when I hear people saying, much as you've indicated, you know, where's the person who can take us above and beyond this and think about this in less than just narrow economistic terms? Or if you like, we're trying to build a nation here. We're trying to build a people. We're not just trying to narrowly maximise GDP. Mm. Sure. Those people are there and the advice exists. But, you know, folk have to be prepared to listen. They don't want to. It can't be the case that their itching ears want to hear all sorts of other things. They have to be prepared to accept the sacrifices that go with that before you will see that type of leadership emerge. So, you know, it's a little bit of physician heal thyself here.
I thoroughly agree with you. On Open House, our guest is Ian Harper of Deloitte Access Economics, a wonderful thinker, great guy. Ian, I want to put this to you that we've reached the stage at the moment with all the difficulties in the Senate notwithstanding and the very fractious nature of politics in the last 4 or 5 years, or 5 or 6 years, in the federal arena, have we reached the stage where policy stagnation on areas like, let's list them off, housing affordability, energy prices, for goodness sake, you know, even the availability of our own gas to use to generate electricity, childcare, for instance, the issue of one of the issues of the week. Is policy stagnation at the point where we're pressing down on the quality of family life, the ability of families to flourish?
There's no shortage of ideas or frankly, good policy, and by which I mean policy which has a wide degree of acceptance, let's say, amongst the profession, that, you know, this is likely to work. It's not that there are no ideas that can't gather support of a reasonable number of people. It is a failure of the political process, if you like, in getting agreement to these sorts of ideas. Now, why is that happening? Well, all of these policies, including the ones that you've mentioned, will have gainers and losers.
Yes.
I mean, take housing affordability, for example. Most economists will say that that's an issue ultimately of supply rather than demand. I mean, if supply is restricted, then, of course, anything which pumps up demand, whether it's lower interest rates or first home loan allowances or whatever, will raise prices. I mean, that's sort of, I think, obvious to anyone who has even the basic understanding of economics. How do you stop that happening? Well, you've got to make supply more elastic, as we say. We need more supply of the sort of housing that people want to purchase, and down will come the price. But in order for that to occur, there have to be changes in local zoning and planning rules. There have to be changes in land use policies. The way and how intensively we allow people to settle, what sort of, you know, apartment blocks we allow people to build. All sorts of things come into play there, and many people will object to those particular things landing, as it were, in their backyard. And it's not that their view should be overridden. They've got their rights as well. But when we come then to the impasse, as you've described it, it seems to be increasingly hard to get people to say, well, all right, maybe this is good for us all collectively, but for goodness sake, this is what it's going to cost me personally, and I'm objecting.
So we come to tricky issues, very selfish issues in some people's minds, like negative gearing, for instance. Is that, has the time come for that to be gone?
Well, you know, negative gearing, as many people point out, it's not just that investment in property, rental property, can be negatively geared. The tax system allows you to negatively gear investments in any asset.
Yes, yes.
Including, of course, shares and, well, frankly, anything. The notion, obviously, being that you're borrowing money for the purposes of making an income which will be assessable for tax. And you can, like many investors do, you can write it off for a period of time until such time as it makes a return, and then you pay tax on that. That principle is well established in the tax law. To make a carve-out or exception for investments in rental housing, you know, it introduces a distortion in the system, Stephen, and that's the problem with it, right? So I think my personal view, and I emphasise to your listeners, this is a personal view, I'm obviously not speaking on behalf of the Reserve Bank or any other body, is that trying to carve that out is a problem, right? My emphasis would always be on the supply side of the housing issue and other issues. We make supply more elastic, more responsive, releasing more land, changing the way that the state governments raise money to pay for infrastructure, right? Smooth that out. Move possibly towards a system of land tax and away from stamp duties. Things like that can alter the dynamics in housing markets, I think, much more effectively than trying to carve a little piece out of the tax law, which could have consequences we don't foresee.
Well, the housing market in Australia defies gravity in a way that baffles most people. It probably doesn't baffle you, but there's a lot of sentiment involved in it.
Yeah.
Even during the collapse, the GFC collapse, the Australian property market pretty much held steady.
Well, and to be frank, praise God that happened, right? That is to say, we didn't have a housing collapse, otherwise we would have had an outright recession, if not worse, in there. That's true, and there's no bad thing, right?
Well, unless you happen, unless you're seeking entry. If you're not already in the market, then you may never be in the market. That's what people are now saying in the city that I live in.
Well, yes, and thereby hangs a very long tail, right? But the transfer of wealth from one generation to the next, that, say, in yours and my generation, certainly in our parents' generations, would have occurred much earlier. You know, when my grandfather, for example, right, passed away in his mid-60s, got his gold watch and basically that was it. So my father received his inheritance when he was in his early 30s. That is not happening now to the younger generation, because yours and my generation, and frankly even our parents' generation, living much longer. So that transfer of wealth from one generation to the next is therefore extended. So our generation holds these assets. The younger generation are having to hold a lot more debt until finally that resolves itself. You would like to think that the financial system would accommodate that difference for a time, but it doesn't seem to be able to do that, at least not as effectively as it should. And so it's true that unless a lot of young people have access to wealth, through loans from parents and this and that, they find it increasingly hard to get through. On the other hand, you might say, well, what's wrong with renting at greater length? After all these baby boomers investing in investment properties, what that's been doing, Stephen, is to keep the growth of rent low. The property investors aren't expecting to make returns from their rental. That's why they're negatively geared. They're expecting capital gains.
Yeah.
Right? And so that keeps the rents low. So a lot of young folk, it's not that they can't get a roof over their heads, it's just setting aside the homeless issue, which is a separate issue, but young people getting into a home, they can get a roof over their heads, but they can't buy it. They have to rent it. Right? And then you say, well, so what's wrong with that? Well, they can't get the tenure. So what's wrong with the contracts, the rental arrangements? Why won't landlords write long-term leases like they do in Europe for people to take houses for 7, 10, 15 years? Why won't they do that? Good question, right? And that might well resolve a lot of issues. The Victorian government's made some changes to try to effect that. But even so, even if you fix that up, the fact remains there is an income tax break and a capital gains tax break for investment in owner-occupied housing that is not available on other assets.
Are there some simple fixes to what you've just described as a very, very complex problem?
Well, no, there is no simple fix. I'm sorry about that. There isn't. As I say, we'd make a start with release of supply. So I do support what the Victorian government has recently done, announcing a whole raft of new land developments in and around the northern suburbs of Melbourne, and also making some changes to the Rental Act. I'm less confident that more money assisting first home buyers will not just be eaten up by the sellers of those properties and lost to the first home buyers. That's typically less helpful. So there's a whole mix of issues, but it is a barbecue stopper, and it is something that we have to think about very seriously, because locking one generation out from home ownership, or even delaying that by a length of time, has significant social consequences.
Yes.
We all understand that.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about what's happened in the United States this week. A drop in confidence, a huge drop in confidence that saw the markets in a bit of a spin late in the week. That's being attributed to people now losing their affection for Trump, seeing that he's not achieved yet the economic miracle that he was promising, the growth miracle he was promising. Do you see any worrying signs in what's been occurring this week?
Well, from an economics perspective, I think what's been occurring is actually quite encouraging. The Fed has now moved, that's the US central bank, has moved to raise interest rates, as it's been signalling for quite some time.
Is that an indication that we'll see the Reserve moving similarly?
Well, Stephen, I can't answer that question. I'm sure you and your listeners would appreciate.
Oh, go on. Give us our first open house scoop, Ian.
No. I've got to fall for that one. No, the timing of what the Reserve... For the record, it's important for people to realise that, of course, that decision is made by the board of the Reserve Bank, of which there are 9 members,
yes.
And I'm only one. But now, when the Reserve Bank of Australia would move its cash rate is a matter for the board and not for me to speculate on.
Of course.
But the Fed has moved, as it's been signalling it would do, and that, broadly speaking, is good news. It's doing that because employment growth, jobs growth in the United States has been strong. The United States economy is actually running pretty close to what economists call its capacity. That's why employment growth is strong. Inflation isn't quite back to where the Fed would like to see it in the US, but it's creeping up again. Those are very strong signs. The politics of what's happening in the US notwithstanding, those are strong signs the US economy is recovering, quite strongly, actually. And the recovery of the US economy after years since the global financial crisis is good news for them, good news for us. In particular, particularly good news if that were to produce some weakening of the Australian dollar, which hasn't done so far, but it may yet do that, then we will get drawn along as well in the wake of the growth of the United States. And given the fact that we've got still stubbornly high unemployment and low wage growth here in Australia, we would love to get a bit more external stimulus coming along. I'm not really the person to ask about reading the politics, Stephen. A man's only been in office for nearly 100 days or whatever. It's very early days, certainly for the sorts of policies that he's espousing. I think the difficulty there is that there a number of the things that President Trump has recommended or intended to impose, restricting imports, restricting immigration, these sorts of things are in the long term, we know, not good for the American people, let alone anybody else, and particularly the constituency who appear to have set their hopes on Mr. Trump. If you start cutting back on imports, then people will find themselves having to pay more.
Yeah, we're back to where we began the conversation with the political process.
Well, exactly. It undermines it. What you do see, of course, is people know that their lives, they want this could be better than it is, right? If the system is not promoting flourishing, and they see this in the level of their individual lives, and that is an issue, and that is valid. The problem then is if they set their hopes on something which sounds good, even if it's in the short term, but there are long-term costs. You know, you really have to say, folks, you're barking up the wrong tree, that this isn't the solution. And the really, you know, distressing point would be if we get down the pike and then people then discover that, yes, these policies that we thought were going to raise our wages and improve our jobs and circumstances have in fact done the opposite. Then, you know, people just feel wholly deceived Well, my prayer is that that doesn't happen, that we get some more rational policy between now and then, but you'd have to say there's a reasonable chance of it.
I wonder if you would care to reflect for a moment on what else happened during the week. First, we had the Coopers situation, where that company responded rapidly and, in my view, incorrectly to being targeted by social media. But then during the week, for goodness sake, a senior manager at IBM, who has a position on a Christian board, as many of us do, targeted because of a faith position, a public faith position of one of their employees. Now, you're a very prominent Christian voice in Australian society, not afraid to say so. What do you think is happening to us, and how should we be responding to this kind of shaming, naming and shaming attack that's happening through our social media?
Well, I would hope, Stephen, that in the name of diversity and inclusion, policies which I strongly support, that diversity and inclusion would include the full range of views and opinions about these significant social issues. There is no doubt that as a community, I'm thinking now broadly about Australia, that we hold different views on a range of matters. And some of those views are faith-based, some of those views are not, but we differ on many things. The whole point of trying to cohere as a society is that we find ways in which we can live together. We can live and let live, as they used to say, that we accept the fact that we basically differ fundamentally about these matters. But nevertheless, right, you know, you are a brother or a sister in Christ. You are a fellow citizen. You are a fellow member of a football club or whatever it is. Yeah. At the end of the day, you are a fellow Australian, and that I support and endorse your rights to say what you believe, you know, within obvious limits. No one wants to support deliberate incitement or into violence or hatred. I mean, none of those things people want. That's obviously the case. But well within that, expressing differences of view from different points of view. I generally think that the push for diversity and inclusion is a very positive thing. And for companies to point out that diversity and inclusion is a source of economic growth, even though that's not the only reason you might want to support diversity and inclusion, I think is also true, right? So, yes, so in the name of that, then, you know, if I happen to espouse a particular point of view because of my faith position, I would like to think that that was a matter which was respected. I mean, argued against by those who hold a different view, that's fine.
Yes, right? That's fine.
I mean, naturally, you know, one welcomes that. That's part of the diversity. That's part of your right to say what you think, my right to say what I think.
The spirit that's abroad within social media in particular is very confused about the role of faith. We're being almost forced to privatise our faith in a way that was not the case when Adam Smith, first economist, and others were thinking policy.
Well,
so,
right.
For the record, then, as a practising Christian, clearly you don't leave your faith at the door when you enter a Reserve Bank board meeting. How do you live out your faith in that context in a way which is appropriate to a pluralistic society?
Well, oddly enough, it was the former politician, leader of the Labor Party, Kim Beazley, who gave me the formula on that. when he spoke at a function years back, I recall, and pointed out that he was a practicing Catholic, at least at that time, and his family was. And, and when he was, this question was put to him, he said, no politician, whether that person is a person of faith or not, no politician goes in to a position of authority and doesn't bring their values with them. Well, I do the same thing. Now, I have no idea what the faith position is of my colleagues, for example, on the Reserve Bank Board or other groups, but I know for a fact that not only do they bring to the decisions the bank makes their own personal values, their own outlook on the world, and their own way of thinking. I mean, that's why they're appointed. If you thought these decisions could be made by a machine, then you would let the machine make the decision.
Yeah.
You're asking people to do it. And so you bring people to this decision, and they bring with that, you know, their best lights and whatever value system they care to bring. As a Christian, I bring my Christian values. And as I used to say when people quizzed me about this when I was setting minimum wages, Stephen, this issue came up, and people thought that, what's a Christian doing this?
Yes.
Somebody said it was even unconstitutional. Let's just clarify that. You know, if there's one thing that's absolutely clear in the Constitution about religion, it's this. And the Constitution only mentions religion twice. And on one occasion, it says, you know, one, the state shall not establish a religion, so the Commonwealth shall not establish a religion, fair enough. And number two is that there shall be no religious test for holding public office in the Commonwealth. So, frankly, if I had been, or any of my fellow Christians or Muslims or Jews or anybody, were banned from serving in a public office, that would be unconstitutional. So anyway, people used to raise this from time to time, and I simply said, look, yes, of course I bring my values. That's who I am. I don't hide that fact. But here is one distinction. The values that I try to live my life by, I don't obviously claim that I do it completely accurately, and people can call me to account, but at the very least, it's clear what they are. They're written down in a book, and that book is publicly accessible. Hmm. And in public places around this great country every Sunday, these values are espoused in open meetings. You can go in and hear people talking about them. You can read books where they're debated. You can ask people. So I would say, so at the very least, you know, you can find out what values it is that I'm espousing and trying to live my life by. You can hold me to account, therefore.
Yes.
And then I would say, but how can I do that for you, right? You know, where are your values written down? Where can I hear your values debated and discussed? And how can I hold you to account on the things that you want to see the world run by? You know, surely I have the right to know that. And I think what I found is that many people sort of faltered at that point and realized that they actually couldn't do that, or at least it wasn't as easy for a lot of folk as it is for people of the book, as they say, for Christians to be able to say, well, look, yeah, there it is.
Indeed.
But as to the notion that people should somehow or other leave their faith, you know, at the door when they go in to make a decision, with the deepest of respect to those folk, I think that's just naive.
Indeed.
And I don't think anybody does it. I don't think it's possible to do it. And even if it were, it would then be incumbent upon everybody, whether you're a person of faith or not, to somehow or other leave outside the room your worldview.
Yeah. Well, that's not the sort of Australia that I'd want to live in. And I suspect if people turn their mind to it, neither would they. Well, Ian, you've been very generous with your time. I do want to ask you one final thing, something we're going to be doing as the Open House program rolls out through the years, months, weeks and months and years. Where do you go to find hope? Are you generally more hopeful than not? And where do you see hope around you for our society?
I am a hopeful person. My ultimate hope, of course, is founded in the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, I am hopeful because of him and because of the resurrection and because of my deep faith that the Lord will return. And moreover, that the kingdom that as Christians we look forward to, that kingdom is already coming. And as I look around and I see all those aspects of this world, as troubled as it is, that are good and godly. You know, you can see, if you like, little green shoots of the kingdom.
Yes.
And every day as we go about our work, we go about helping the Lord to bring that in.
Yes.
The kingdom will come here. It is coming. That is something which gives me great hope for the future. but in a somewhat sort of less eschatological perspective. Yeah, I'm hopeful about this country and the future for this country, Stephen, because of the enormous... Well, frankly, my friend, because of the people, right?
Yes.
Because of the enormous well of goodwill, of skill, of bonhomie, of openness in the community as Australians. You know, the future for us, you know, narrow, even just thinking narrowly and materially, is enormously favourable. And I spent a lot of my time trying to, well, disabuse people of the impression that this place is going to hell in a handcart. I mean, you know, the opposite is the truth.
Indeed.
We have everything it takes for this community, this society, to grow from strength to strength. And I hope not just materially, but to grow from strength to strength as an example of a loving, supportive community of very different people. Some of whom, you know, ideally more of whom, would confess to the Lord Jesus Christ. But you know that his love extends to every last one of them. And his hope extends to them all coming to know him at some point in their lives.
What an inspiration you are. Ian, thank you so much for being with us.
That's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you, and thank you to your listeners for listening.